to give some lectures just on random topics that we thought was interesting.
Your microphone up.
Oh, thank you.
And so one of the topics came to mind, I think it was during Joel's lecture. He was talking about black holes and ADS-CFT with a finite temperature. And in passing, he mentioned that you could think about hydrodynamics in this framework. And it so happens that that's something I've lectured on at various summer schools. And so I thought I would recycle some of those slides and share my enthusiasm for that topic with you. This is actually a topic that's been a real industry in string theory in the past, I don't know, 5 years, maybe longer. And one of the reasons is it's a place where string theorists are using their fancy techniques to make contact or try and make contact with the real world. And so another title for this talk could be ADS-CFT and the quark gluon plasma. And that's why I have this fancy picture here. This is actually a picture of the ALICE detector at the LHC. So what are we going to cover? Well, here's an outline. There's some introductory stuff about ADS-CFT, and we should all know about that. And that's very basic. I left it in just because that way we're all on the same page and there's no doubt about the way I speak about ADS-CFT and what you hear. I'm also going to talk about this idea that perhaps we can make contact with experiments out there in the real world. If the goal is to tell you about holographic hydrodynamics, I should tell you what hydrodynamics is. Even without holography, just so we can set the framework. That would be a course in itself, and I'm just going to focus on a few salient ideas to introduce hydrodynamics. One of the key, or a key idea that I'm going to pull out of hydrodynamics is something called Kubo's formula, because that's very useful in the next section. And so there, I'm going to make my first foray into describing hydrodynamics in the context of ADS-CFT. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you a famous result, 8 over S equals 1 over 4 pi, or the calculation of that. And that's a classic result. It's something that all string theorists or all holographers should see once, kind of like the calculation of G minus 2. It's something you ought to do once, just so you can say you've done it. There's also this section on a broader description of this, or a modern understanding, where it's called fluid gravity correspondence. But I expect that we're all going to be tired, especially me, by the time we get there. And so I may skip over that section. And then I'll just have one transparency where I say this is the end of the lecture. Okay, so let's get started with the introduction. Again, ADS-CFT. What are we doing? We're doing quantum gravity in anti-de Sitter space. And on the other side of the duality, we're talking about a conformal field theory, a theory without gravity. And of course, this is holography because we go from d plus 1 dimensions down to d dimensions. Sometimes we say on the boundary. Our favorite example, of course, is coming from string theory, type 2b superstrings. We have this background, ADS5 cross S5. There's some fancy Ramon-Ramon fields in there, and there's a flux that has a quantum number, introduces a quantum number, n. And then on this side, we understand that by studying D3 brains, we understand that the dual theory is a gauge theory known as n equals 4 super Yang-Mills, and that quantum number appears as the rank of the gauge group, SUNC. To make the correspondence, we have to write a dictionary that relates the two sides of the equivalence, and the dictionary starts as follows. Well, there's a coupling constant. It's actually the Tuft coupling that organizes the diagrams or the contributions in the Yang-Mills theory. and it's actually Giang Mills times the number of colors. On this side, we know that that's given by the curvature scale of our ADS space to the fourth power divided by the string scale to the fourth power. There's also directly then the Yang-Mills coupling in our gauge theory, and that's related to the coupling constant in the string theory. And then basically the past, almost 20 years, is improving on that dictionary, trying to find more and more entries so that we have a better understanding of that equivalence. The real problem is that this is a lie. This isn't what we do because we don't know how to do this superstring theory, or we're not very good at it anyway, because those Ramon-Ramon fields that support the geometry cause all sorts of technical problems in the way that we understand string theory. And so we take this limit where we're actually just doing gravity or supergravity on that side rather than the full string theory. And in fact, we're not even doing quantum gravity, we're just doing classical gravity over there. And what that amounts to is taking a limit where the coupling constant is very, very small in the string theory, and the curvature scale is the scale at which the geometry is curved is very, very large compared to the size of typical strings. This controls the quantum corrections over there. This says that we can work to lowest order in a derivative expansion, or alternatively, when we write down the action for our fields, the higher curvature or higher derivative interactions aren't important. And we can focus on the Einstein action. When I use the duality, this sort of corner of parameter space turns into a corner of parameter space over here where the number of colors is very, very large. The Tuft coupling is also very, very large. And so this is known as the Tuft limit, where everything's dominated by the so-called planar diagrams. There's still lots of loops here, but we organize them using the counting that we saw very early on so that these are called the planar diagrams.
We have this marvelous correspondence. However, I said that what I wanted to talk about was a system in the real world. We have a gauge theory in the real world, or the best known one, is quantum chromodynamics. But that's very, very far away from this fancy N equals 4 super Yang-Mills theory. In particular, here we have three colors. Here I said there were a large number of colors. Here I have fermions that transform in the fundamental representation of this gauge group. In fact, there are three families of them. Over here I have a bunch of fermions and scalars, but they're organized in a completely different way. This is a conformal theory. It's supersymmetric. Because it's conformal, there's no confinement. On this side, we know there's all sorts of interesting physics. There's a confinement scale that leads to a discrete spectrum. There are effects like chiral symmetry breaking. And so this kind of physics obviously is very different from this kind of physics. So what is one to do? Well, one thing one can do is work a lot harder. You can try and break the supersymmetry. You can try and break the conformal symmetry and build different kinds of holographies. You can do that in two different ways, sort of in a principled way, using the tools of string theory, which is sort of a picture where you work at very, very high energies and work your way down using those sort of fundamental theories to build a model that might describe something closer to QCD. Alternatively, you can use the phenomenology of QCD to sort of tell you what the holography should look like, and so you work from the bottom up and build some kind of gravity theory that has the properties that you would like. And in fact, I think Lilia is going to tell us about this next week, a little bit maybe, So we'll hear more about this, but that isn't what I'm going to do. That's not what I'm going to talk about. Instead, the way I want to make a contact with QCD is through a different angle, I'm going to be talking about finite temperature. And so finite temperature is something that naturally breaks supersymmetry, and it naturally breaks the conformal symmetry because I've introduced a scale into the problem, namely the temperature. And this is, as I was saying, an area where there's been all sorts of activity by string theorists, and it's really been driven by a miraculous connection, two surprises. One comes from the real world, and that is experiments at a place in Brookhaven or out on Long Island called the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider, or RIC. They've discovered a new phase of nuclear matter, or of QCD, called the strongly coupled quark gluon plasma. And it seems that that plasma, rather than acting like a free gas of quarks and gluons, acts like a fluid. And in particular, it acts like a near-ideal fluid, which is characterized by this particular ratio. There's something called the shear viscosity, which we'll talk about more later, over the entropy density, and you get a number that looks like this, 0.08 to 0.16. And I'll just ask you to take my word for it that those look like small numbers. Certainly, they're orders of magnitude smaller than any other material known, or that, you know, the kinds of materials we examine in the lab, or in my glass here. It's, I think, two orders of magnitude smaller than the viscosity of my Pepsi. Surprise number two, though, came from the string theory side, where people were trying to understand the hydrodynamic properties of our super Yang-Mills theory using ADS-CFT. And what they found was, well, it's string theory, so you get a very elegant answer, 8 over S is 1 over 4 pi. But when you really evaluate that, what you get is a number 0.08. And so this number looks very much like that number. And so people started wondering, is there really a connection between this kind of strongly coupled gauge theory, or the plasma here, and the plasma up there? And as I'll describe, there are perhaps hints, or there were hints, that maybe there is a connection. Part of the reason they were, I guess not part of the reason. What I wanted to describe is a little bit more about how that first result came to be. So this is a picture of the lab out at Brookhaven. You can see that it's dominated by this. If you're looking from Google Maps, this is just a pile of dirt or a scratch in the ground. But underground here, there's a tunnel where there are two counter-circular, or what they do is they accelerate gold ions, and then there are two counter-circulating bunches of gold ions, and they're collided at various intersection points around the ring, where they create interesting explosions that come out into the detector. Now, when they collide, usually, well, what you might think is I have a nucleus here and another one here, and they come together head-on and smash, and I get a big explosion. In fact, that's a hard thing to do. It's hard to get them around the ring and to smash into each other. Usually what happens is they just partially overlap. They hit each other, but not directly head on. And so what happens is that the region that you create in the collision is an overlap. Well, it's kind of like here. If I'm looking down the beam line, one of the gold nuclei here is given by this circle. Here's another one. When they collide, they overlap in this region here, but they're not completely overlapping. And as a result, this region where you create the explosion actually has some structure to it. Oop. And so the question is, or you can use that structure to ask, did I produce just a free gas of quarks and gluons, or did I observe something that acts in a collective way? The way they decide that is, well, in this particular case, if I just created a bunch of free gluons and quarks, they would just head off in random directions out into the detectors, and the distribution here of particles as you go around the beam axis would be uniform. On the other hand, it turns out that if you have a plasma or a fluid-like, a collective behavior, then there are stronger gradients going across the narrow direction. The pressure is given by some constant in the middle, and it has to go to zero at the edge of my fluid, and so the gradient is stronger going across the narrow direction than it is going across the long direction, and so more stuff actually comes out the sides than goes out the top and the bottom. And so that leads to then an uneven distribution. And so they've measured, they do these experiments, they look to see is the distribution even or not. And in fact, what they find is that it isn't completely even. And so here are some graphs from some experiments, and this is some moment. Essentially, they do a Fourier transform in the azimuthal angle, and what you're seeing here is that this number being non-vanishing is just saying that the distribution is not even. They have to work hard, though, to reproduce the data, which are the dots here. And part of that working hard is they do a hydrodynamic simulation of what this flow would look like. And what they find is, in their simulations, that the results are sensitive to this parameter, eta over f. And so you can see, as they change that parameter, the curve moves up and down. And, you know, it's a work in progress, but here you can see, in this particular case, when they do the fit, they get a value of 0.08. In this case, they've changed the model slightly, and when they do the fit, they get this particular value. So these are these small numbers that I was talking about before. So as I said, this is a little bit of a work in progress, but what they're getting to come out is really a small number when you compare it to other kinds of materials. And so that's a real challenge for theoreticians, because you're talking about a system where the coupling is strong, and you're talking about a system where it's not static. In fact, it's an explosion, so it's a very time-dependent situation. And there are no real tools that we have to do calculations in a situation like that, strong coupling and time-dependent. And so the theorists were left casting about, and then this remarkable result came along. That seems to be actually a very broad result, or almost a universal. It was thought to be a universal result in the early days. But it's certainly true that all theories with an Einstein gravity dual seem to reproduce this number, which is, again, close to the QCD result. And so people wondered, you know, does that universality extend to all strongly coupled gauge theories, including QCD? And then if so, perhaps this is a new way to calculate, a new tool, since in ADS-CFT, as I'll show you or we'll see later in the lecture, you know, it is a tool where you can do calculations like this. And as I said, there weren't any other calculation or tools in the toolkit to study that from a theoretical point of view. So having noticed that, you know, you might say, well, it's just a coincidence. And so I have to build up, or people built up a story to try and motivate how this could be more than just a coincidence. And so what we commented on before was that when I talk about QCD and when I talk about Super Yang Mills, the physics of those two systems is very different. On the other hand, what I said is I wanted to study not the system in the vacuum with a few quarks or a few gluons roaming around. I wanted a very highly excited state. I wanted to create a finite temperature plasma. And let's see what happens then. Well, here I have a strongly coupled plasma where I've got gluons and then matter, albeit Most of the matter is in the adjoint. There are tricks we now know on how to introduce a little bit of matter in the fundamental representation. On this side, again, you know, the coupling constant here is strong, and it's still strong in this regime where I've just gotten to the deconfined phase. And so I have a strongly coupled plasma of gluons and matter, albeit the matter in this case is definitely in the fundamental representation. When I talk about physics here, you know, I use words like the plasma is deconfined, there's screening of the charges, there are finite correlation lengths when I probe the plasma in different ways. When I talk about the physics here, I use exactly the same set of words. And so this kind of physics is starting to sound like this kind of physics. And so I've got this label saying that in this regime, perhaps the physics is the same, or at least it starts to sound very familiar or similar. But I have to emphasize that here what I've done is I've said that I'm at finite temperature, but I'm just above the deconfinement temperature, because I know that if I go to very high temperatures, the coupling constant on this side runs, and eventually we will get to a regime where it is just a weakly coupled system. And so what I'll have on that side really is going to be just a free gas of quarks and gluons roaming around. On the other hand, this is a conformal theory. It starts strongly coupled here, it's strongly coupled here, and it's always strongly coupled, independent of what the temperature is. And so if I go to very, very high temperatures, you know, this similarity goes away, and I would be, you know, the physics of these two systems is very different again. And so it's only in this intermediate regime where I can hope that there's some kind of similarity between what string theory gives us access or gives us the ADS CFT to calculate and what we see in the experiment or in the real world with QCD. But you can hope or you can wonder, you know, is there some kind of universal behavior that extends not just across a broad class of holographic theories, but extends to describe this kind of physics on that side as well. So here was our surprise. You know, is there any other evidence that perhaps this story I was telling you is true? With hindsight, people went back and they said, well, maybe there is. In fact, people had been studying finite temperature QCD for quite a while, not in the lab, but using lattice simulations. That's not a dynamical situation, but it's something where you can study the thermodynamics of the system. And so what's plotted here are, it's the energy density divided by temperature to the fourth for various QCD-like flavors. In this case, I have three flavors of quarks. Here I've got two flavors. This actually means there are two light flavors and one very heavy flavor. And you can see that there are different curves. But they all, you know, here's the confining phase. There's not a lot of energy density, or it's hard to stick energy into the system because all I can access, say, are the pions or the hadrons. But then there's sort of this deconfinement phase, and it gets a lot easier to put energy into the system. And what you see are these plateaus saying that the energy density goes roughly like T to the 4. Now, you can actually organize that in a little bit better way. The reason they said epsilon divided by T to the 4th is they were expecting to find a free gas. And in a free gas, there's a simple dependence on the temperature. But there's a precise coefficient that you get. So in a free gas, the energy density epsilon naught goes like T to the fourth, but then there's a pi squared over 30 times the number of degrees of freedom. And so what I can do here is take those graphs, and rather than just plot T to the fourth, I can include that specific coefficient and plot epsilon over the expected energy density. And what you get is a curve like this. And so, whereas we had those simulations being spread out, at least over a range here, when you include that extra factor, counting the number of degrees of freedom, in fact, they scrunch up like that. However, one thing that we can note here is that we didn't get a 1. So this system here is not behaving like a free gas. On the other hand, it is behaving like T to the 4th. Now, another surprise that I'll review again, but we heard about already, is that you can calculate with ADS CFT and you can get an energy density and it does go like T to the 4th, but rather than 1, what you get is that ratio being about 0.75 in the ADS CFT. So that's a famous number, what was noted at the time was that, well, isn't it surprising that we have this strongly coupled, super Yang Mills plasma, and that the answer is anywhere on the same graph. It's not, a free or weakly coupled super Yang Mills would give us, this result here. But in fact, that strong coupling, rather than being orders of magnitude different, it just shifts by some 25%. It ends up being the same factor, yeah. And so the other surprise, though, is now I'm putting it together with lattice simulations that are simulating something that closely resembles what we see in the real world. And you see that this curve, this ADS-CFT curve, actually fits fairly closely. In fact, this curve certainly fits better than the one that they were originally aiming for. And so that's suggestive that perhaps there is some kind of universality that covers all strongly coupled gauge theories, not just these holographic ones, but that maybe there are certain properties that extend to all theories. However, what this tells us is you have to organize the information in the right way. The other thing I can see here is that we're not going to be able to describe all of the physics, or with at least the naive ADS-CFT. See, this is just a straight line and goes all the way down to zero temperature. Whereas, these theories, there is interesting physics here. It's flat for a while or almost flat, but then there's this confinement phase, and we're not, I'm not describing that, but there is some hope. Perhaps I can describe this part of the curve or this phase, which would correspond to the strongly coupled quark gluon plasma. And so this is, a suggestive thing. That the RIC, what we think is those experiments were probing the quark gluon plasma in this regime. This is actually ongoing LHC physics, where there are experiments being done for 1 month a year. They actually collide, I think it's now iron nuclei at the LHC. And so they're probing a regime somewhat at higher energies. And so they're out here somewhere on the plateau over there. And that's what I said, that ADS-CFT isn't going to give us all of the physics of QCD, but maybe there's some hope that we can talk about that plasma phase or the plateau that's right there. Again, remember that at very weak coupling, what I expect, or at very high temperatures, I am going to get to weak coupling in these theories. And so I do expect that somewhere out here, these curves do have to angle up and approach that first dotted line that's a 1. However, here I'm very close to the deconfinement transition. And it seems that I get just a nice plateau that may or may not correspond to what we see in ADS-CFT. Oh, and then here's a warning. I've been giving you a lot of propaganda. It's a nice story, but it's a story, and you should be careful of what salespeople and theoretical physicists want to sell you. Here is another plot of lattice data. And here's this plateau that I was talking about in the energy density. But there's another curve there. That other curve is actually the pressure. And what we'll see later is that in a conformal theory, this energy density and that pressure should be correlated. So in the n equals 4 theory, what you would find is that the pressure also runs across here. Not quite, well, there's a factor of 3, but it doesn't sort of gently slope down like that. And there's this quantity epsilon minus 3p that will vanish for the quark or the Super-Yang-Mills calculations. But here, the lattice simulations are showing that in QCD, it really doesn't appear that quantity vanishes. In particular, near the deconfinement phase transition, it really seems that there's some interesting physics where that quantity spikes, although it then tails off. What Rick was... And I'm not sure what I was trying to say with that green line. But what Rick was probing was that I said just above the transition. And so we're actually in this regime here where there's quite a difference between, what we expected in a conformal theory and what we're getting in these lattice simulations. On the other hand, I know what this curve was. When we're doing LHC physics, we're probing out here where that spike is tailing off. And so what this was is how far is the energy density from the free energy density? And in some sense, that gives us a baseline. That's what we hope, or that's what the free quark gluon plasma should give us. And so what that's saying is, well, if that's a defect in that model, you know, here, this defect is saying that a conformal system or an ADS-CFT system is giving you an even worse approximation, since I wanted this to be zero. On the other hand, here, the deviation in that quantity, or the deviation away from zero, is about the same as the deviation here. So perhaps in this regime, the quark gluon plasma being described by ADS-CFT is as good a model as we were in, as good a model as, or better model than thinking of it as a free gas. But it's also a warning that eventually, you know, you can't expect perfect results. There is interesting physics here that ADS-CFT, as it stands, thinking of it as a conformal field theory, just doesn't capture.
I have a
question. Yeah.
There's sort of standard lore, I guess, that as you approach a critical point, systems are supposed to behave sort of more conformally. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, it seems to be the exact opposite. You have this parameter that's supposed to vanish for a conformal theory, and it's getting huge near the critical temperature. So is there some insight into why that...
I think what you're thinking, though, is second-order phase transitions.
Okay.
And this, if we go back here, this really doesn't look like a second-order phase transition. I mean, if anything, you might have thought that it's a first-order phase transition in that you seem to jump here from one level up to that level very, very rapidly. It turns out that... the QCD people have argued very long and hard about that fact, and this isn't actually a phase transition at all. Rather, it's supposed to be just a very rapid crossover. But that phase transition or crossover really doesn't have anything to do, I think, with the kind of physics that we're used to thinking about for second order phase transition. Are there other questions? Okay, so now we're going to move on. Actually, that's interesting. I'm going very slowly. Okay, in any event, hydrodynamics. What is hydrodynamics all about? So we're going to set aside ADS-CFT, and we're just going to think about hydrodynamics. What is that?
Well, hydrodynamics is an effective theory that I use to describe the motions of fluids or perhaps a plasma. And what I'm doing is I'm not following the microscopic details of the system. Rather, I'm just following long distance properties of the system on long distance scales or over large time scales. And so what one does is, in some sense, in a language that high energy physicists use, you integrate out the microscopic degrees of freedom and make a derivative expansion of the long wavelength degrees of freedom or the long wavelength properties of the system. Now, as I said, that's a language that we use in high energy physics. And in high energy physics, in fact, it goes by the lore of something called effective field theory. But here I'm talking about, I started with the title hydrodynamics, not effective field theory. So why are the tools that we may learn about in our particle physics courses not applicable here? Well, the real difference is that when I'm talking about the fluids or the plasmas, that's a system where there's dissipation. And an action principle is not appropriate to describe those kinds of systems. Here we're, again, sort of in this regime where we're basically in the vacuum and we're just tickling the vacuum with small excitations. And so that's a regime, well, it's something where many times over, effective field theory has proven a very useful tool. However, when we include dissipation or when that's important, then hydrodynamics is instead our tool of formidable tool that we can apply. And instead of using an action here, what we do is we work with equations of motion. So in hydrodynamics, what's the equation of motion that we use? Well, we say that there's conservation of energy and momentum, i.e., if I organize the properties of the plasma or the fluid can be the stress energy tensor. But an overarching principle is that that should be conserved, i.e. this divergence vanishes. And that's the simplest case. You might also have various charges, but I'm only going to work with energy and momentum, and we're not going to worry about the extra bells and whistles that come, or that can come, in describing systems where there are extra conservation laws. So to describe the system, I imagine that I have a fluid, that varies on very long distance scales over long time scales, and I'm going to characterize the little elements of that fluid with a temperature, and that temperature may depend on where I am in the fluid. And I'm going to characterize it by the velocity, or the four velocity, actually, of each little element of the fluid. And so there's a constraint on the four velocity that it has to be even in curved space. U dot U is -1. And basically what I'm saying is here is that, I have this fluid and the properties may vary, but in each little element that I study locally, these microscopic degrees of freedom are interacting and moving around quickly enough that they reach some kind of thermal equilibrium in each individual element. And so it makes sense to talk about a temperature for each element of the fluid, and that there's a collective motion that I can describe by this four velocity. In any event, given this constraint, we can do a counting. There's three variables here. There's one variable there. Here I have four equations. There's one uncontracted index. And so it seems like I've got four equations for four variables or four unknown functions. And so we're laughing. We've got the right setup. As I said, there's going to be a derivative expansion. We're going to assume that the properties, the four velocity and the temperature, are slowly varying. And so I'm going to organize the stress tensor in a derivative expansion. So at first order, there are zero derivatives.
And in fact, we write down the familiar expression that we see, or we may have, hopefully we've seen, for an ideal fluid. Perhaps you saw this in your GR course. But there is basically, if I'm thinking in flat space, this is like a zero, zero component. And that one I call the energy density. Here I've got this tensor, which is actually the metric plus this bilinear in the four velocity, the local four velocity. And what is that doing? Again, if I think of this in flat space and a stationary fluid, you know, in the zero, zero component, this is minus one. These guys only have zero components, and it's one times one. And so that component of this delta tensor vanishes. And then the remaining diagonal components in my eta mu nu give me 1, 1, 1 in the three spatial directions. And so what this is saying is that the diagonal spatial components of the stress tensor in that situation are just what we call the pressure. And so this is a more covariant way of writing it. If the fluid is moving around, then the energy density is actually this component of that, and the pressure multiplies this interesting tensor that's given here. And this is just saying that tensor by construction is orthogonal to the four velocity, so it defines the spatial directions in, if I think of the rest frame of an element of fluid. So if I want to solve for the properties of the fluid, for instance, if I wanted to study, how the density or the pressure varies in a particular situation, perhaps in the atmosphere, I'd need an extra piece of information. I'd need what are called the constitutive relations or the equation of state. I'd have to know something about what is epsilon or the energy density as a function of temperature. What is the pressure as a function of the temperature? And then what I could do is I could use this basic structure and my conservation law, the conservation of the stress energy, to solve for the temperature and for the four velocity given some set of boundary conditions. And that's usually what the story of hydrodynamics is about. You pick your favorite fluid. Hopefully you can look this up in a book, and then you solve for some interesting flow, perhaps the flow over a wing or through a pipe. In fact, what we're going to be doing is turning it around in ADS-CFT. We're not so interested in different kinds of flows, but what we're going to do is we're going to watch the plasma using our holographic screens or whatever, our holographic tools. We're going to watch the plasma move around. And by watching it move around, we're going to understand what these constitutive relations are. We're going to try and figure out what is the energy density as a function of temperature. What is the pressure as a function of temperature? And that's something that we've actually seen already in our some of the lectures that we're given. In any event, we're not doing ADS-CFT yet. We're just doing hydrodynamics. I said this was the zeroth order term in an expansion. In fact, for us, conformality is an important feature of the plasma, certainly in the Super-Yang-Mills theory. And the hint was that perhaps the quark-gluon plasma is conformal in this phase just above, or nearly conformal in this phase just above deconfinement. That imposes an extra constraint, which we may remember about from the very beginning of the course, namely the trace of the stress tensor has to be equal to zero. And that gives me this constraint that I talked about before. If I apply that constraint here to the zeroth order stress tensor, then it turns out that the pressure has to be related to the energy density by a factor of 3. So that's just taking the trace of that matrix that I described before that had the energy density and then 3 pressures on the spatial components of the diagonal. That gives us that. So far, though, this is something that doesn't have any dissipation. I said the big thing about hydrodynamics is we can accommodate dissipation. well, there's no dissipation here because we're working to too low an order. I have to go to the next order to start to see something dissipate. And so I'm going to look at T1. I said it was a derivative expansion, so in these terms, I should see derivatives. And sure enough, here I do. There are basically two contributions that are multiplied by, again, some coefficients. This one's called the shear viscosity. This one's called the bulk viscosity. What are those tensor structures? Well, basically what I've got is the four velocity, and I'm taking a derivative of it. And then what you would do, well, that defines a tensor. It's got two indices. What I would do with that is I would break it up into the pieces, the antisymmetric piece, the symmetric piece, and the symmetric traceless and the tracy part. And so that's basically what we're doing here. The antisymmetric piece doesn't contribute because the stress energy is symmetric. So we just throw that one away. This one is basically the tracy part of that tensor. And then this one is the symmetric traceless part of that tensor. The one extra thing that we've done here, or that the hydrodynamicists have done here, is they've stuck in all of these delta tensors. Remember, those are sort of the projectors on spatial directions. And that comes by way of a choice. And the choice they're making is that the four velocity contracted with T1 should vanish. What that's saying is if I go to the rest frame of a little element of fluid, then that says that T00 of this contribution up there vanishes. And in some sense, that's just a definition, sometimes called Landau gauge. But what Landau told us is, you know, there's something called the energy density, and I'm just going to define it to be, when I go to the rest frame, it's just the 0,0 component of the stress tensor. And so all of this dissipative stuff, or all these higher order corrections, in his definition of hydrodynamics, are only going to involve spatial components, or components that vanish when you contract them with the four velocity. So, yeah, okay, so that's what this, so here I've not just including T1, but I'm including all the higher orders. That's where the dissipation is, and what Landau tells us is I'm going to choose a definition, or I'm going to define the theory in a way such that that contracts with U to give me zero. Other people have made other choices. This is just a favorite choice. I mean, there is some kind of ambiguity in how you set up your hydrodynamic equations, and this is a convenient way to fix that ambiguity. One thing I'm showing you here are derivatives of the four velocity, but in principle you might think that why don't I have derivatives of the temperature? That was the fourth thing that I have to solve for. Or alternatively, I can think, why isn't there a derivative of the energy density? And that comes about because what we're doing is an expansion, and we're working perturbatively. So I'm supposed to think that T0 is the most important part, T1 is the next most important part, and then T2. But the importance of these contributions goes down as I go up in the expansion. And so implicitly what I've done here is I've said that I can use the lower order equations for T0 to simplify the structure of T1. In particular then, if I wrote down derivatives like that in T1 and tried to build some kind of tensor structure, it turns out that I can replace them by derivatives of the four velocity. And so a simple example is given here. If I think about the component of that derivative in the u direction, it turns out that that's equal to this divergence. And so that particular gradient then gets subsumed into this particular term up there. Where did that equation come from? Well, what I did is I said at zeroth order, this divergence vanishes. But it turns out that this equation is just a contraction of that with U. then you could, well, I leave it as an exercise. You have to worry about, well, are the spatial or the components sort of in the directions described by delta also, you know, do they also give me derivatives of u? And somebody's worked hard, and I'll tell you the answer is yes. And so when I introduce derivatives here, I only have to introduce derivatives of the four velocity, and I can forget about derivatives of the temperature. So we had this these two coefficients appearing here. They have these fancy names, viscosity. Those are names that we've heard before, but what do they really mean? Well, in particular, shear viscosity, I said, is going to play a big role in today's discussion. And so what does that do? Well, you think about, in the simplest case, a fluid flow where there's a gradient in the velocity. So here the fluid is flowing in this particular direction, but there's a gradient. Right at the boundary here, the fluid doesn't flow at all. Here it flows, say, with 1 meter per minute. Here, 2, 3, 4. In a situation like that, there's going to be stresses in a fluid that try and even out this flow. So there's going to be a stress between this layer and that layer that tries to slow this particular layer down and speed that particular layer up. And those forces are described by these components of the stress energy tensor. And the shear viscosity is defined as this being given by the shear viscosity times, well, the gradient of the velocity here. And if you plug in our definitions of what u is and what sigma was, that's exactly what you would pull out of that for a slowly moving fluid. So u is basically one, well, it's this one here. U is approximately 1 V in the x direction, 0, 0. And so that's a physical picture of what that coefficient is doing. It's a coefficient that measures the kinds of forces that are trying to even out the flow of the fluid. Similarly, bulk viscosity over here is something that measures the stresses or forces that are induced in the fluid that are trying to resist expansion in the fluid flow. However, we had this rule again. If I'm thinking about a conformal system, the trace should vanish. At zeroth order, that imposed this restriction. If I impose that restriction on T1, essentially what that says is that the bulk viscosity vanishes. And so in our conformal fluid, the only contribution at first order is this term here, proportional to the shear viscosity. We can work harder, and people have worked hard for us. And I don't have a reference up there. But what you find is at next order, there are all sorts of structures. Again, there are more derivatives here. Implicitly, what I have are two derivatives of u appearing in various tensor structures. There are new coefficients. Here, this is called some relaxation time called tau pi. Here, what we have, this omega, is sort of this anti-symmetric part of that derivative. By itself, it couldn't contribute, but if I have two of them or combinations, you can get it to contribute to T mu nu. And then there's also an interesting term here, as well as derivatives of the four velocity. You might notice that I described everything as though it was moving in a general background, a curved spacetime background. And so you can have derivatives acting there, and you get curvatures appearing in the various tensor structures. And typically, we're going to be thinking about fluid flowing in flat space, or in flat, Minkowski space. But it turns out that keeping track of these terms is going to be important in understanding the fluid, as we'll see in a moment. These terms are all for a conformal fluid, so if I take the trace of this thing here, I'd find that it vanishes. On the other hand, if I have non-conformal fluids, this equation gets even more messier, and there are 8 extra terms that one would have to write down. But we're not going to bother with that.
This is just advertisement. I'm not going to really tell you anything. Basically, the idea here is, okay, so if you have some epsilon, some energy density, some equation of state, the energy density, some P, pressure as a function of temperature, if you know what the viscosity is, what you can do is study those equations and think about fluctuations around a uniform plasma, and what you find is that there are modes that propagate in the fluid. Namely, there are sound waves, there's something else called the shear channel, and there's another set of modes called the scalar channel. Alternatively, what I can do in ADS-CFT is turn this around by looking at various excitations propagating in the plasma. I can get insights into what the equation of state is here, or perhaps what the shear viscosity is here. I won't worry about that comment. Yeah, so it gives us access to various parameters. Instead, I'm going to move ahead to Kubo's formula. This is a tool that I'm going to use, or I'm going to apply in section 4. It's a tool, again, it just comes from basic hydrodynamics, but it's going to allow us to get access to the shear viscosity. So the basic idea is I've got some system. I mean, this is a language that we're used to. We've got some system, and we want to probe it. And the way we do that is we introduce various we put in various sources or disturbances, and we see how the system responds in different places. And so how we do that in a theoretical framework is we say, okay, here's our original action, and we introduce a new term, where I'm probing with a particular source that couples to a certain operator in our theory. Now, the assumption is going to be that we're in a system, and I'm going to define the expectation value of that operator be zero when I turn off this source. So in some sense, that's a definition. If this wasn't zero, I would just shift the operator to subtract off whatever that is and get a zero. But the point is that if I make a small disturbance, if I have a small j, then the expectation value should be linear in j. So that goes by the fancy name linear response theory. And you can work through, and what you find is, well, I make a disturbance here at y. There's a Green's function that tells me what the response is at some distant point, x. Turns out that the appropriate Green's function in thermodynamics is the retarded Green's function. And here's a fancy formula that just says these words here, that what we use in that formula is the retarded Green's function. Now, what are the operators and sources of interest here for hydrodynamics? Well, the operator, the natural operator that we've been talking about, is the stress tensor itself. Perhaps from our experience with general relativity or quantum fields in a curved space-time, we know that there is a natural source to associate with the stress tensor, and that is the metric of the space-time geometry. And so when I probe the system with a small source, what I'm going to do is I'm going to deform my flat space by small disturbances in the metric. I'm going to introduce small h's, and those are going to play the role of the j's here. And the expectation values that we're going to measure, well, we're going to measure the expectation values or the response in the stress tensor when I introduce those disturbances. And so what Kubo did is he used these ideas to learn about. Well, he didn't develop the full Green's function, but he learned about properties of that particular Green's function and how it was related to different properties of hydrodynamics. So again, this is a big area. There are lots of things I could say. I'm going to focus on one particular idea, which is let's pick a very special disturbance in the H mu nu. I'm going to take flat space, I'm going to introduce an
HXY is going to be uniform across the entire space, but I'm going to let it vary in time. And so my system's going like that, slowly, but that's all it's doing. Turns out that if I have a fluid sitting at rest in the room and the space-time just does that, or the background metric does just that, that fluid starts at rest and that particular disturbance doesn't send it moving anywhere, basically because it's uniform across the entire space. So the fluid starts at rest and it ends at rest. And so the only effect, if I look at the hydrodynamic equations, U isn't doing anything. The only thing that appears in our hydrodynamic equations is this HXY, but it's appearing, you know, in the derivatives, or it's hidden in those derivatives because they were covariant derivatives where there are Christoffel symbols, or there were explicit places actually where there were metrics. For example, in the ideal fluid stress tensor, we saw a metric. And at very higher orders, what we saw were curvatures. And if you go to even higher orders, you would find derivatives of curvatures. And so in those hydrodynamic equations, then, these things get turned on, but U is still going to be given by that particular simple value. And so working the linear order in H, if I write down the T mu nu that we had before, what we find is that the only contribution is in TXY. This is from T0. This is the ideal fluid contribution. There's a contribution from the shear viscosity term. And then this is just higher order stuff that we don't have to worry about. Turns out that, well, this note is just, even if there was a bulk viscosity, that particular, that doesn't contribute in this particular equation. This is supposed to be compared to that equation I had before. So here's my source, the HXY. Here's TXY, the response. What comes in the middle there had to be a Green's function. If we, what's done is usually we Fourier transform. Turns out that in the case of interest, I said it was uniform across all space. So there's zero spatial momentum. It's varying slowly in time. And so there's an omega contribution. And if I look at the Fourier transform of this particular side of the equation, what I find is there's a constant term, and then there's minus I omega times the shear viscosity. And then this, basically, higher derivatives give me higher powers of omega. But in the low frequency limit, these are the dominant terms. And so, well, if we compare those two equations, what we can see is that I can relate this coefficient to the Green's function that was implicit in that construction. And so what Kubo noted was that the shear viscosity, what I have to do is calculate the Green's function. There was an I over there, so I take the imaginary part. There was an extra omega, so I divide that out. And then I take the limit, omega goes to zero, to kill all the higher order terms. And the result is the shear viscosity. So if I can calculate the Green's function, I can get access to the shear viscosity of our system. However, for what we're interested in, i.e. QCD, or the strongly coupled quark-gluon plasma, or n equals 4 at strong coupling, that's a really hard calculation to do, because I want to do a calculation of a Green's function at finite temperature and at strong coupling. And so ADS-CFT, in a moment, is going to turn that hard calculation, that hard field theory calculation, into a simple gravitational calculation. And that's really the magic of ADS-CFT here. And so here's a note. That's a Kubo formula. There are lots of them. So here's one that tells me about the bulk viscosity. OK, so that was going to be. So here's a result that Kubo gave us. I said that what we wanted to do is we wanted to understand what that coefficient there is in this particular, well, in a holographic setting. And so how do we go about that? we start doing ADS-CFT. I went the wrong way. So again, what we saw the other day is that the CFT thermodynamics, or the boundary theory thermodynamics, is just black hole thermodynamics in the bulk. So we take our ADS-5 and we replace it by a black hole metric. And so basically I stick in these extra blackening factors and there's a horizon at R equals R naught. We do this usual game of wick rotating. So time went from Minkowski time to Euclidean time, T sub e. Now there's a coordinate singularity here. It's not a horizon, but I can smooth out the geometry there by picking the appropriate period, which it turns out is just pi L squared over R naught. But then if I'm working in the boundary theory with a Euclidean time that's periodic, that's an indication that I'm doing finite temperature field theory. And so I can interpret that period, or the inverse of that period as the temperature of the system. And so it's given by that expression there. And there's a small lie, but we'll ignore that. I can also calculate the entropy using the standard gravitational formula. Namely, I just take the area of the horizon over 4 times Newton's constant, and I get some expression. Well, here's my 1 over 4 times Newton's constant. I pick out the measure factor in front of the dx's, or in front of the horizon. That's that, and then I integrate over the horizon. Again, this is a planar horizon, so in principle that's infinite, but we imagine that there's a cutoff in that integral that's much, much larger than any of the other relevant scales in the problem. Another way of dealing with it is we just divide by our volume to look at the entropy density, and what we get then is a formula that looks, well, it looks like this. I can translate it to a 5-dimensional formula like that, or I can translate it to a gauge theory formula like that. And so I think that's what we saw the other day. There's some interesting numerical factor. There's an NC squared here, and then there's the temperature cube. And that gives us the entropy density of the super Yang-Mills theory at strong coupling. And so what you see is that this is one of, or well, the entropy didn't appear in our hydrodynamic formulas, but this is like extracting a constitutive relation using holography. Yeah, and there's the 3/4 that we talked about. I can also calculate the energy density using sort of ideas of the Euclidean path integral, or the Euclidean quantum gravity path integral. Again, what we do is we identify the Euclidean gravitational action evaluated on shell or for our black hole metric in terms of the free energy divided by the temperature. And then they're just standard thermodynamic formulas that give us the energy density. I'm going to try and run through another way to think about this. Not only can I get the energy density, in principle, we have this field operator correspondence in the ADS-CFT dictionary. And so, in fact, I should be able to construct the entire stress tensor in the boundary theory when I'm looking at this plasma or this black hole. And so this is just a reminder. Again, it's supposed to be a reminder of something we know about, namely this field operator correspondence. So think about a massive scalar field propagating in ADS space. If I look in the asymptotic regions, I see that various solutions drop off in a way that there are 2 independent solutions. This is a second order equation, so I expect that there are 2 independent solutions. And they go like r to some powers. In particular, here's r to the minus delta, where delta satisfies this equation that basically controlled by m squared l squared. There are actually 2 different solutions here. There's a delta plus and a delta minus. And the other power over here is related to that one by that expression here. Remember, we're in 5-dimensional ADS. But again, the reminder is that the standard definition is to go the right way. is that this power that I call delta, I choose this delta plus root, and then this other power over here is just minus delta minus. And so this is minus delta plus, minus delta minus. How do we distinguish those two modes? Well, one is called the non-normalizable mode. The other one's called the normalizable mode. And so if I was really turning this on, and how do we remember that? A simple way to remember this is non-normalizable and this is normalizable is to think about an ordinary mass squared, i.e. where this is a positive number. In that case, this delta plus is a positive number, but this delta minus is a negative number. What that means, because delta minus is a negative number, that means that's growing as I approach the boundary. This mode is getting arbitrarily large, and if I wanted to try and normalize it or take the norm of the state, I would get an infinity because it's, well, the field just grows out there. If I took into account back reaction, in fact, it would destroy my asymptotic ADS space-time. On the other hand, delta is a positive number. This one is decaying away, and so it has a finite norm, it's a more docile mode as I look at the asymptotic geometry.
Sorry.
Yeah?
But the second one would grow towards the center of the space.
That's right. So something interesting happens at the center of the space. And what we have to figure out, let's carry on with the reminder then you can tell me if you're happy or not happy.
Isn't this only sort of the asymptotic solution for large?
That's only the asymptotic solution. Yes.
So you shouldn't conclude anything about what happens at small r.
Not yet. And we don't actually, I'm going to tell you in a little while, we don't really care because what we do is, I get to say the words, first of all, that this one, the coefficient here of the non-normalizable mode, which doesn't have to be just a constant, it can be some arbitrary function, it turns out, of the coordinates on the boundary, that one is acting like a source current. So that's like the J's that we talked about before, and we should think that we're coupling some operator to the boundary theory with this phi naught times some appropriate operator, and that operator has precisely conformal dimension delta. Phi 1 is like the response, it's like the expectation value, and so I should think that this mode or this coefficient here is giving me the expectation value of that operator, that same operator that has dimension delta. Now what am I really going to do with that? At the end of the day, ADS CFT tells us that the partition function or the path integral in the CFT is equivalent to the string theory partition function. However, the sources here are identified with these asymptotic behaviors. But what do I really do, and why don't I really care that, the space-time, what happens at nonlinear level is, what I do is I take these variations, that brings down various operators, but then to evaluate a correlator like this, what you do is you set the sources equal to zero at the end of the day. And so you only look at a linearized response to the system, typically. You don't actually turn on phi naught to a finite value, which would destroy your space-time. But as we'll see, there are questions. There were two independent modes, but you need to have some boundary condition that relates one mode to the other, and that boundary condition comes from precisely how they interact or how they interact with the geometry in the interior. And we'll see that very explicitly in a moment. This is just the reminder. In fact, we don't do that string path integral precisely. We work in this very simple limit where I just use a saddle point and I evaluate the classical gravity action with on-shell solutions. This logarithm of Z that appeared here, or the thing that I use to calculate these Green's functions, is just actually the variation of that on-shell action with respect to the sources. Why am I writing that formula? Remember, this is basically a Green's function for two operators. That's precisely the kind of thing that appeared in Kubo's formula. And so this is the kind of thing that I want to use ADS-CFT to calculate. And this is the way you do it. You evaluate the on-shell action, and then you take these variations with respect to the asymptotic modes. So I simplified life there by writing a scalar because there aren't any indices. In our particular case, we're interested in the stress tensor. That's the operator, as was discussed. That's dual, or the dual field that we study in the bulk are gravitons or metric fluctuations. And so there are going to be metric fluctuations that correspond to the non-normalizable modes, our sources coupled to the stress or various components of the stress tensor. And the normalizable mode is going to tell me about the expectation value of that stress tensor. Now, there are all sorts of complications, as I hinted, because there are indices here. There's also, this is a gauge theory, or we're talking about gravity, which has a diffeomorphism invariant. And so you have to work harder to completely understand the story when I'm talking about the stress tensor. But again, somebody's worked hard for us, and we can just look up the answer. And it looks something like this. The rule is that you arrange your metric in a very special way so that the R part sort of has this trivial structure. It's just dr squared over R squared. And then all the interesting stuff happens in the gauge theory direction, or the dx mu part of the metric. And so here there's a g mu nu that has an expansion in powers of 1 over R. In this coordinate system, the boundary is at R equals infinity, and so these are getting progressively smaller. This is G naught. That's the non-normalizable mode. That's the one that is the main, that's the source, or it gives us the background metric in which the field theory lives. The expectation value comes, you know, here delta is zero, and so the G4 is actually the normalizable mode. However, the expectation value is a little bit more complicated. There's a long expression that looks like this. It has, you know, to leading order, it has this contribution G4, but you also have to fix it up with these particular terms involving that potential term there. If I say that the metric I'm interested in is the black hole metric, well, it doesn't quite have the right structure here for the dr squared part, and so I have to do a coordinate transformation basically to get rid of that stuff. But there's a simple coordinate transformation that you can do that basically gives us that form out to a very high order. I mean, this isn't perfect, but it gets you know, the deviation from that out to something like 10th order or whatever, 1 over r to the 10th there. It also turns out that because G naught is flat, that G2 vanishes. And so, in fact, I only have to read off the G4 part of the metric. And if you work hard, well, it's actually not that hard to do this coordinate transformation in this metric. What you'll find is G4 takes this particular structure here. And so you can recognize that as the stress tensor that we associated with an ideal fluid. The fluid isn't going anywhere, and so this is like the four velocity terms. And then there was a term proportional to eta mu nu. Now, it doesn't look like there's a pressure term and a energy density term, but remember, this is a conformal fluid. So the pressure and the energy density are related to each other, and that's why there's a 1 here and a 4 there. And this particular coefficient gets translated to gauge theory stuff to give us that expression there. But I can read off from that both the pressure and the energy density. And that's saying that, well, okay, you might note, or take note that the trace of that is equal to zero, but that, I said, was a consequence of conformal invariance, so that's a good check. And I'm still not going to tell you what the energy density is there. Well, the energy density is sort of the three part here. The energy density is 3 pi squared over 8 nc squared times t to the fourth, and the pressure, well, is just that. It's the coefficient of the g mu nu part. And we had calculated these other formulas before. This from the horizon area and this from the periodicity of Euclidean time. So this is actually the leading part. I mean, we're starting to get that information about the leading part of, the constitutive relations that appear in the hydrodynamic formula. We have the energy density and the pressure as functions of temperature. So you could have guessed for a conformal fluid that it had to go like t to the fourth. You might have guessed it was an nc squared. And so what we're really finding are these precise coefficients with the pi squareds over 8 that are characterizing n equals 4 over some other conformal field theory. Okay, so now we got to buckle down and we got to do this calculation because I said this is the calculation, or this is going to give us the classic result for the shear viscosity. And remember, Kubo told us it was related to this particular Green's function with xy components. I take an imaginary part, and then I divide by omega, and I take everything in this limit. Well, actually, first of all, it's spatially uniform. The spatial momentum is zero. And after manipulating it, I take the limit omega goes to zero. And so what I want to do is convert the calculation of that Green's function or Kubo's formula into a gravitational calculation. And I'll remind you that the way we do that is we evaluate the on-shell action, not just for the black hole now, but for the action of the black hole with a couple of perturbations in HXY that are the sources for that particular Green's function we're interested in. So we consider Muttrick fluctuations in HXY. And so I'm going to force you to see the entire calculation. First thing we do is we make a change in coordinates. And what that does is it puts the horizon at u equals 1. Because there's a 1 over r squared, it also puts the boundary at u equals 0. And so it, the metric doesn't look any harder, but it organizes the calculation in a very simple form. Now, what we want to do is we wanted to probe the system with variations in HXY. And what that means is we wanted to vary the components of this G naught. And it turns out what that means is we're going to perturb the space-time, the black hole metric by something that has this radial profile. It drops off like 1 over U. Or that's the asymptotic behavior, but then there's this interesting radial profile that we'll have to figure out. But asymptotically, that's going to go to 1. That's what the non-normalizable mode did. And we're working in Fourier space, and so there's in the x and or the gauge theory direction, we've got a frequency and a momentum. So k here refers to the four momentum, omega. The nifty thing, though, is that solving, if I take this, plug it in to the equations of motion, I find that the equation of motion for this radial profile is precisely one that somebody studied or that we might have studied if we were looking at a massless scalar field. And so, in particular, we're going to address this question, how do I know what phi 1 is if I'm given phi naught, or vice versa? And what I said is there's something about the way the scalar field interacts with the space-time or the ADS deep in the interior that's going to fix or relate those two coefficients. And so here the interesting structure in the interior is the black hole horizon, and we have to choose some nice or non-singular boundary conditions there. If we look at the equations near the horizon, what we find is that the equation governing that radial profile takes this simple form. So I'm near u equals 1. That's where the horizon is. There's some derivative terms, and then there's a term that depends on omega squared. It's also got r naught, but you can reorganize that as being omega over the temperature squared. And so there are two possible solutions for this, going like plus or minus I omega over t, and a factor of 1 over 4 pi in there as well. But what is the boundary condition that I want? Well, it turns out that, you know, I'm supposed to think in terms of a retarded Green's function. That means that I probe the boundary and stuff falls into the space, but there's not stuff supposed to be coming out of this, the interior. And so it turns out that what we want is an infalling boundary condition. There's stuff falling into the black hole, but not coming out of the black hole. And that tells us then that we should choose this, or we should throw away the plus exponent and only keep the minus exponent. That's, well, it's perhaps the natural boundary condition in this particular case. It says that black holes absorb, the probe that we get. We'll come back to that picture later. So now we remember that in Kubo's formula, we can throw away the spatial momenta, and we're only really interested in omega being very, very small. And what we want to do is we want to evaluate the leading contribution to that particular Green's function. And apparently here I wrote it out. There it is. So we could leave it at that, or I'm going to say a few words about where that answer comes from.
Question. Yeah. It looked like Q didn't enter that formula. Is that?
That's one of the miracles of horizons. What I did is an approximation that U is approximately 1, and so Q appears here in the equation, but it's multiplied by powers of 1 minus U. And so in these, these three terms are all the same order, but I've thrown away a whole bunch of terms here. And in fact, all of the terms with Q were higher order, and I could just ignore them. But I kept it just to, well, perhaps it went by too quickly. But it was kept in the equation just to show you that fact that the horizon doesn't care about Q.
This is sort of related to the fact that you can kind of think of the horizon generators as being independent in their evolution in some sense. That sort of, if you're along a null surface, that one, the sort of null generators sort of can't talk to each other because there's...
I haven't thought of it that way, but it may be related to that, yeah. Yeah. But then at this stage, I'm going to turn Q off, well... We're almost going to turn it off anyway, because in Kubo's formula, we don't care. But what was I supposed to do? I was supposed to evaluate the on-shell action, but the part I'm interested in are the part with these fluctuations in my hxy, or fluctuations, it turns out, in this, I've put all of that into this radial profile that I've called phi. So what I said is that the action, the quadratic action, looked like a massless scalar field, so it takes this form. This scalar field, though, I'm sticking in solutions, and so I can integrate by parts. I pick up a boundary term here at infinity, or in the u equals 0, but the bulk term just has the equation of motion. It's just going to give me phi box phi, and phi box phi is 0, and so that entire action, when I evaluate it on shell, just is the boundary term out at infinity. And so what I want to do now, or what the prescription that I wanted to, or that I provided before, is that there are phi naughts hidden here, and I should take the second variation with respect to phi naughts. I'm going to do it a little bit differently. I'm going to do it a lazy way, which It's not a lazy way, it's a clever way, it turns out. I'm going to gather up all of this stuff, and I'm going to call that pi. That's like a radial momentum. It turns out that this is the variation with respect to the radial derivative of phi. So that's why it's called a radial momentum. And that, you know, a priori, there's no particular reason to write it that way, except that these clever folks said, this is a good way to organize the calculation. And so this is just a change of notation. I've taken all of that and I've written it as pi, and this is my on-shell action. Now again, what I was supposed to do was find the phi naughts that are hidden up there. But I know that as I go to the boundary, those phi naughts are the leading contributions in this. And so rather than worrying about the variations, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to evaluate that combination out at infinity. That naturally has the leading terms here have two phi naughts in them. But I was supposed to take the variation. Well, I just divide out by two phis, and that normalizes the whole expression, or it divides out those phi naughts. And what's left over is this Green's function that I was looking for. In fact, if I look at this ratio, I've got this same, again, I'm working in Fourier transform space, and so this is the opposite form momentum of that, but I see these two phis cancel, and so in fact, I'm left with this expression. That Green's function is just the ratio of what I call this radial momentum over phi, here evaluated at the asymptotic boundary. And that will give me the desired Green's function. In fact, it gives me more than I wanted, because at the end of the day, I'm going to set that to 0 and take the limit omega small. So why was that so clever? Well, that was clever because because they wanted to take this limit. So now we're setting q to 0, and we're thinking about omega small. And then let's think about, this is the shear viscosity, so we've taken the imaginary part, thrown in the 1 over omega, all that stuff. But let's think about how these quantities vary, pi, say, varies as a function of u. In the limit that omega is small and q is 0. Well, it turns out that the equation of motion was just basically the derivative, the radial derivative of pi equals, and then the other derivatives, the x, y, and z derivatives, or t. And so you get, on this side, the radial derivative of pi, and then you get an omega squared times phi. And it's just omega squared because I've set q to 0. And so there's no other contribution here. There's some complicated radial stuff here that have to do with geometric metric factors that contract up indices and whatnot. But the point is that this radial derivative is order omega squared. And in fact, in the limit that omega is small, I'm going to say, well, I might as well just treat this as 0, i.e., I might as well say that the order omega squared, pi doesn't vary at all as I move around in the radial direction. Turns out that you can make a similar argument for how this combination in the denominator vary. Because phi equals a constant is a solution of the massless equation, it turns out you can argue that the derivative of omega times phi is also order omega squared. And so again, what we're going to say is to order omega squared, this particular combination is a constant. I might as well evaluate it, or it doesn't vary to the order that we're interested in. And so that was really the trick of Iqbal and Liu. By organizing it in this way, I see that the Green's function, or the shear viscosity, is given by this quantity. But that quantity originally was evaluated at the asymptotic boundary, but I argued because we're taking this low momentum or low frequency limit, we might as well treat those as constants, and we can evaluate, in fact, this ratio in that limit
anywhere we want in the bulk space-time at any value of u. Where's a clever place? Well, if infinity is one interesting place, the other interesting place in the black hole is at the horizon. And it turns out that that, well, given what we've already done, that's a particularly simple place to evaluate this ratio. We know that at the horizon, phi goes like this. You can evaluate what pi does. It also has, well, you just take a derivative of this expression, you get out an omega, you get out some other factors, and then it's proportional to that same expression again. And so when I evaluate that ratio, I just get some simple number. Yeah.
So this quantity, you have this quantity that doesn't depend on u. Is it some related to some conserved quantity or something? I mean, I realize it's only valid for small. Is there a way to see that, or is it really just a coincidence or a trick or something?
I don't think there's any deep, or well, I certainly don't have any deeper understanding of it other than it's a trick. And it's a trick really that relies on this particular, taking this limit. In some sense, it might be related, well, okay. It might be related to the fact that precisely in the omega equals zero limit, I can add just constant factors here in phi. It turns out that's related to doing a diffeomorphism in the some kind of trivial diffeomorphism in the bulk geometry, where basically you just realign the coordinates. Maybe it has to do with that. There's some simple diffeomorphism that leaves the geometry invariant at omega equals zero, and so perhaps that's what's telling me that when omega is small, this is conserved up to order omega squared. I don't know. But in my book, it was just, it's a really, well, if you've evaluated or tried to evaluate these things before, this is like the simplest way to do it. So it's a very useful trick. In any event, I did it for you in real time, but if you want to go away, it's not that hard. You can evaluate that ratio now at the horizon. What you get is some simple constant. And you can translate that constant to gauge theory variables, and what you find is, again, something going like nc squared. There's a t cubed, it turns out, dimensionally, that's what I needed. But the key that ADS-CFT gave us was that particular coefficient, pi over 8. And then what I said is there's this famous result. When we take that and divide by this previous quantity, the entropy density, what we get is an expression, 1 over 4 pi. Some notes are that eta, the shear viscosity, is actually huge because n squared, the number of degrees of freedom, is going to infinity, which seems to contradict the idea that people go around saying that the plasma behaves like a near ideal fluid, or they say that the viscosity is small. But what they mean is that relative to the number of degrees of freedom or relative to the entropy, it's very small. There are a huge number of degrees of freedom, so it's not surprising that the viscosity is small or large. But when you take the ratio, this measures the number of degrees of freedom, then that ratio is very small. This is a picture that actually, this was the 10-second take on dissipation that Joel actually gave us when he talked about kicking the black hole. Basically, what we're doing is we probe the system, we introduce a source here, and we're measuring the response. Where's the dissipation? Well, when you do that in the case of a black hole, some of your probe falls down through the horizon. And that absorption here is essentially the dissipation in our Yang-Mills plasma that's caused by, well, in this particular case, by the shear viscosity. And so there are some comments there. The one that I'll focus on is that that kind of calculation is readily extended to lots of different backgrounds. And it always comes out to be 1 over 4 pi. And so that gave rise to this idea that, at least in this particular limit, that all gauge theories should give us some kind of universal result. Note that this is independent of the rank of the gauge group, and it's independent of the coupling, albeit that we're in a corner of parameter space where they're both large. And so perhaps that's universal enough that it carries over to other strongly coupled gauge theories. And so these folks actually, well, they weren't saying that this was true for all materials, but they said perhaps it's a lower bound on all materials, all physical materials. Unfortunately, it turns out that you can disprove that conjecture, but it still tells us that in holography, we're going to a very interesting corner of parameter space where fluids or plasmas behave in a very different way from what we're used to. And at that point, I'm going to quit. I'm not going to try and, if you want, you can look over the transparencies. I'm happy to give you them to you, or we can even talk about it. But there's an interesting story which sort of says how you can capture all of this hydrodynamic framework in sort of a uniform description of black holes in an interesting expansion. And then my concluding remarks are just that this is a holographic hydrodynamics has been a remarkable, it's been remarkable in that it's given us new insights into strongly coupled gauge theories, but it's also given us an opportunity where we may be able to make contact with real world systems, i.e. the strongly coupled quark-gluon plasma. And so there are lots of, besides what I've talked about today, there are lots of extensions that people have developed in various directions. I hinted at looking at corrections for in 1 over n or 1 over lambda. People have looked at different kinds of matter fields. People have looked at fluids that aren't conformal. Remember, I said that that would be important near the deconfinement transition. But there's a huge literature now on what all goes under the umbrella holographic hydrodynamics. But I've already, I think, overstayed my welcome, and I'll just quit there for this evening, unless there are any questions. No questions.